So we're kind of contemplating what was the next step for this property when Eric called and said, hey, can I come in and talk about grazing? And kind of hemmed and hawed and said, yeah, I guess it doesn't hurt to have the conversation. Yeah. So they came in and talked about what their goals were and how they were already running their grazing program and how they envisioned it going. So we thought, well, can't really screw it up. So let's try it. And it's the plan B. And so far, it's been working very well.
Welcome to the 376th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. Leave it alone. It's not surprising that when it comes to revitalizing natural habitat, that mantra often rules the day. In a way, such an attitude makes sense. After all, it's often human-centered land use that disrupts and harms the processes that create healthy, resilient ecosystems. But there are times when a little intervention is necessary, especially when it comes to something like a native grassland that's being reestablished on formerly farmed ground. It turns out such habitats require disturbance to be healthy. As the Area Wildlife Manager for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Whitewater Wildlife Management Area in southeastern Minnesota, Christine Johnson often must grapple with decisions about when to let nature take its course and when to step in. For example, half a dozen years ago, it became clear that a 15-acre former pasture that the DNR had planted to prairie was struggling. In fact, when the agency tried to burn the rocky ground in order to control invasives and boost the growth of natural grasses and forbs, there was barely enough plant-based fuel available to support the blaze. So, when Eric Hines approached Christine with a new strategy for managing the land, she was open to a different way of doing things. Eric, who farms with his wife Michelle across the road from the DNR land, is raising beef cattle utilizing managed rotational grazing. As we discussed in Ear to the Ground episode 375, Eric is the kind of farmer who's not afraid to ask the question, why not? In this case, he was wondering why he couldn't make that prairie land part of his grazing rotation, and thus provide that habitat the periodic disturbance it needs to thrive. So, since 2019, he and Christine have had an agreement where the cattle being raised on Hoosier Ridge Ranch have a chance to browse the forage available in this reclaimed prairie. As Eric makes clear in the podcast, he's pretty pleased with the results. Grazing the DNR land provides low-cost forage while giving his own pastures needed rest. But what does the conservation professional think of the arrangement? After all, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is not in the business of raising beef. Its mission, among other things, is to support healthy, thriving ecosystems that serve as good habitat for wildlife and pollinators. After a recent field day at Hoosier Ridge Ranch, sponsored by the Land Stewardship Project and Practical Farmers of Iowa, I had an opportunity to get Christine's side of the story. As this interview shows, it turns out that grazing natural habitat provides a way for farmers and conservationists to come together around some shared goals. And when that happens, the land, as well as the farming community, can benefit. Christine started our conversation by talking about how, as a natural resource expert, welcoming bovine hooves onto a restored prairie requires taking a fresh look at the relationship between a natural ecosystem and working farms. So Christine, we just had a great field day here at Hoosier Ridge Ranch, where we saw what they're doing with grazing and converting some crop acres to grazing, that type of thing. But at one point in the tour, you talked a little bit about kind of a partnership that you have with Eric and Michelle Hines related to grazing a wildlife management area. And I guess before we go into the details of that arrangement, I think some people might be a little bit surprised that a natural resource agency who is all about promoting wildlife and supporting wildlife and healthy ecosystems might be open to grazing of livestock. And I was wondering, has there been a little bit of a change in mindset related to that?
Yeah, there has been some change, but it is conservation grazing. So it's not the stereotypical grazing regimes of the past. So it's definitely changed quite a bit from what people might envision. But it is very heavily focused on conservation goals with the cattle. So we make sure that the way we're grazing, the density, the timing, all of that is really focused on the goals we're trying to achieve on that piece of property. There are also other mitigations. So for example, we have deworming requirements, spray on insecticides, some of the the typical brands or insecticides that are used are not allowed. So there are other restrictions that are in consideration of wildlife, and that would be mostly pollinators in those cases. We also don't typically graze too early in the season, and that's to mitigate issues for ground nesting birds. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure we give them enough time and enough habitat to produce nests and get their babies well on their way. Cattle typically don't go onto sites until well after the nesting season, and then they're pulled off usually before hunting seasons kick off in full force. So we had cattle out definitely through small game and archery deer seasons, but before firearms we did pull them off so that it's not a conflict of interest there. So it's definitely still compatible with their primary uses for WMAs.
Well, and speaking of compatibility, you explained that one of the first things, if a farmer comes and approaches you to talk about grazing, what's very important from the onset is to figure out what goals they have, what goals you have, and what maybe where the two dovetail a little bit. To talk about that, I think that's really important, because a farmer is going to, their goal is going to be to get some cheap forage and all that, but your goals are going to be different. But there's that doesn't mean there can't be some overlap there.
Exactly, yeah. Typically, from a producer standpoint, they're looking to add pounds under the cattle, mm-hmm. and as cheaply and maybe as quickly as possible, and we can definitely help with that because we typically do a lot of vegetation management. And so if the cattle aren't out there, we're mowing it, or we're haying it, or we're burning it, mm-hmm. so it's just a different tool in our toolbox to do that vegetation management, and then it also benefits the producer.
So describe maybe what would be a typical meeting of the minds, or how does that work where the farmer or the rancher comes and talks to you about grazing? What are some things that you kind of sit down and some ground rules you go over, that type of thing?
First, we kind of have to hash out exactly what our goals are. It's making sure that we make that clear to the producer that mm-hmm. it's land management. We're not in it for the cattle production side of it, and that'll be a benefit for them. But really, we're looking to manage this habitat as best that we can, and the fewer inputs we can put into it, the better. So usually we talk about we're looking to improve habitat by increasing species diversity, structural diversity, reducing non-native invasives, typically brush, and the cattle definitely help with that quite a bit. Once we're on the same page that way, then we discuss the how and the when and the where and the why kind of behind all of it. So making sure we discuss stocking rates and density and timing, how we're going to rotate the cattle, how often, what signs are we going to look for in the pasture to tell us it's time to rotate. So just making sure we're all clear on that. And it does get all outlined in our grazing plan as well as our grazing agreements that are annual. So it's a little bit repetitive, but that's because it's so important to be on the same page.
Right.
We want to set it up to be successful for both of us.
And it seems like in the big picture, as far as, and this is way oversimplifying, but your goals are to, some of the big goals that you have is to improve habitat, but also kind of, I guess, as a sub area of that, maybe to control invasive species. Is that another big one?
Oh yeah, that's a lot of the work that we do is invasive species. We're overrun with buckthorn and honeysuckle, especially down here. In some cases, cattle can be used to sort of trample it if you do really high stocking densities, but typically then you have faster rotations. So it's just kind of balancing what your goals are and how you can make it happen with the producer.
There is a fee that farmers have to pay, but often that ends up, because they're paying for the fencing and that they can get, that kind of wipes it out. But can you explain that, kind of how that works a little bit?
Yeah. Yep. So we do use the county like ag acreage rates, but the rates we have are typically pretty old, but they still work for our needs. So we start with that as kind of a baseline, and then we factor in the work that the producer is putting into the land. So if they purchase the fence, that comes out. Typically we purchase the fence, but we don't always have the budget. So if the producer purchases it, typically they do install it. They maintain all of it. They get a deduction for providing water, and depending on how they provide that, the deduction may be more or less. They also get deductions for how many times they rotate cattle, and then if at the end of the grazing period, if they remove the fencing, they get a deduction for that as well. Typically, we can get that to work out to zero or pretty close to zero.
So let's talk a little bit about this arrangement that you have with Eric and Michelle, how many acres it is and what kind of habitat it is and kind of what some of your goals are for this.
Yeah, so this particular piece that we are grazing with Eric and Michelle is 15 acres. It is planted prairie. When we acquired it, it was grassland that I believe was pastured way back when. Mm. Not much for soil profile, so very rocky all the way across the 15 acres. We did throw out some native prairie seed. It was a really low diversity mix, mostly tall grasses, and it didn't take very well because there wasn't even enough soil profile for the natives.
We are in karst country.
Yes, yeah. So that was sort of a first attempt at it, and we weren't looking to do a lot of inputs to it, but we did try to burn it in 2016. There wasn't even enough fuel to carry the fire, so it was a lot of manpower to try to get anything to burn, and it was very disappointing and underwhelming. So we're kind of contemplating what was the next step for this property when Eric called and said, hey, can I come in and talk about grazing? And kind of hemmed and hawed and said, yeah, I guess it doesn't hurt to have the conversation. Yeah. So they came in and talked about what their goals were and how they were already running their grazing program and how they envisioned it going. So we thought, well, can't really screw it up, right? Yeah, there's nothing there to damage.
It's not
so.
Doing well anyway.
Right. Yeah. So let's try it. And it's the plan B. And so far, it's been working very well.
What is a typical season? What's it look like? When's he coming in? When's he, how long are the cattle there? That type of thing.
Yeah. It's hard to say what a typical season is.
Yeah,
we've had a lot of...
Yeah. You've got to adjust to the weather.
Right. Yeah. It's very weather dependent. And we've had some drought the last couple of years. But this year, very lush. So typically we're targeting the cool season grasses. So we're in there early, usually May-ish, but it might depend a little bit on which herd he's putting out, whether it's the custom herd or his own herd, and their calving timing too. Some calve better out in the field further away than others. So that's a little bit up to the producer. But if we can get some cattle in there in May to target those early season cool grasses, that definitely helps to suppress those. And they rotate. There's each pasture is about 5 acres. So there's 3 5-acre pastures total. They're not in there for very long. And again, he's looking at the vegetation. So when it gets to 6-8 inches tall, that's when he rotates the cattle to the next pasture. And once he's been through it once in that early spring season, then typically he pulls them off onto another one of his pastures and then keeps an eye on it, and they might come back through. They might come back through when the warm season grasses are kicking in lightly. But as you saw on our pasture walk, I mean, there's still a lot of vegetation there. It is definitely not a golf course. There's still lots of good tall vegetation standing. And then typically they do go through again in the fall, again targeting those cool season grasses, trying to suppress those, let the natives come through a little bit better and get established.
So how long have you had this arrangement with Eric and Michelle?
I was just looking back at our records. I think we started in 2019. But as he mentioned too, we didn't graze every single one of those years. Mm-hmm. It's just reading the landscape and seeing what's out there and trying to determine what's best for it year to year.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, is letting the land kind of decide. Yes. You can't just say, well, I've got to produce this many pounds of beef this year. So one of the things you mentioned I thought that was really interesting. So this is an area that's really got a lot of farmers and ranchers excited, which is bale grazing for a lot of different reasons. But it sounds like you're kind of excited about it for maybe a different reason. It kind of fits in with some of your goals. Can you talk a little bit about it? And you're baling... describe it. You're baling some prairie grass,
right.
And then, yeah, to talk about this a little bit, I thought that was really a neat way where these two goals, these various goals of the farmer and the resource manager can kind of come together.
Yeah, I think so too. Typically with a prairie, we develop a seeding plan for it. We pick out all the species we want to put out there. We do all the site prep on it, which is labor intensive. We typically buy all of our seed and end up spending quite a bit of money on it. And then we either contract the planting or we seed it ourselves. And for the next couple of years, we do typically mow off the annual weeds just to help get the sunlight down there, get the prairie grass off to a good start, and the forbs too. So it's pretty labor intensive on our side of things. But with this situation, the grazing specialist that we worked with suggested that we do bale grazing. So we have other native prairies that were planted in the area on the WMA very nearby. One of the other guys that was here tonight is actually the guy that baled the prairie for us, and it was an exchange of services. So he kept some of the bales sort of in payment for providing us with these bales for Eric's cattle to then graze. Mm. So they baled off our native prairie, hauled the bales over here, put a couple out at a time for the cows to pick away at. And you can either do that during like the warm season, where then they're not focused so much on the growing vegetation, so you're letting that be, and then you're spreading that seed out, or you can do it really later in the season after that seed has matured on those bales. Well, before it's harvested, the seed is matured, then you bale them, bring them out here, seed's all ready to go and be distributed onto the site. The cattle pull it apart, kind of spread it around the whole site, fertilize it for you, work it into the ground, you get really good seed-to-soil contact. So it really seems to be working very well.
Yeah, well, that was, and I guess just overall, kind of the bottom line, you've been doing it now since, it sounds like it's been 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking? I guess the bottom line for your viewpoint, your biased viewpoint is it improving that habitat?
I think it definitely is. Yeah. I haven't seen it this growing season, unfortunately, but in years past, there's definitely more diversity in there. It's native species that are providing that diversity. and it's structural diversity. So it's definitely moving in the right direction. Prairies take a while. This one maybe is taking a little longer than our typical plantings, but we've also have fewer inputs on our end of it. Mm-hmm. So that trade-off, from my perspective, is very worth it.
Yeah.
I was at a farm a couple months ago that was using grazing and some other systems to really focus on grassland bird habitat. And one of the things that a bird biologist pointed out to me was what they like about adaptive grazing or conservation grazing is it creates a mosaic habitat mm-hmm. for birds, which is, I don't think people think about that, but that's really important for particularly grassland birds.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have some of that on this site just by timing the grazings differently. Having the three pastures, each of them looks a little bit different each year. But then also comparing this site to some of our sites nearby, being that we're grazing this site, maybe we burned a different one. So those look very different, and they provide that diversity of habitat for the different bird species and others around in the area, too.
I know I've done a couple of interviews with folks in western Minnesota. The DNR has done more of this because there's more open grassland type of thing. And here we're in the driftless area, and it's much more wooded, that type of thing. So there isn't as much opportunity. And what kind of area do you manage, and do you have a feeling for what percentage of that or how many acres could be maybe managed this way through grazing, roughly?
So I manage 27,000 acres with my staff at Whitewater. I'm not sure how to quantify how much would be grazable. We don't have a ton of prairie, unfortunately. It's one thing we're working on that's a goal is to increase our prairies not only in number but also in size. Mm-hmm. Our biggest contiguous prairie is only about 60 acres, so it's actually pretty small compared to a 27,000 acre unit. So looking to increase the sizes of our prairies, also hoping we can increase the grazing opportunities we have. However, I think the more limiting factor might be our staff time just to get it all set up because they do require staff time to get them set up and do some of the monitoring and just communicating with our partners, making sure we're still on the same page.
And I think what's exciting from the grazing standpoint that maybe fits into this is there's been so much advancement in lightweight portable fencing. Mm-hmm. And now people are, and I know Eric talked a little bit about the, GPS collars, the wireless grazing or fenceless grazing, I guess it would be called. So that helps because part of the, cattle can do a real number on woodland habitat, that type of thing. But if you can, this new fencing systems seem to be able to help keep them out and you can adjust work with the land a little bit more.
Yeah, I've been to some workshops actually talking about the GPS technology, and it's really exciting if they can get it to do what you need to do. Hopefully it does work out, because that would be excellent, not only for cattle grazing, but for the goat grazing we do on some of our bluff prairies. It really even minimizes how much input you have and how much staff time or, just man hours in general that are required for it. And then it might allow you to rotate more often, too, mm-hmm. Which is a big advantage. So I think it's really exciting what might be coming.
So it sounds like also there's been some use of goats, particularly in goat prairies. That's why they call them goat prairies. These really steep areas where it's really difficult to do invasive species. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know buckthorn and they can really do a number on those really steep. These goat prairies, for people who don't know, if you're driving through the driftless area, you see them up on the side. It looks like a bare patch in the woods, but it's an actual prairie on the side of these really steep bluffs.
Yeah, they're typically south and southwest facing slopes where they get more sun. They are prairies, but they're on the steep bluff side. So typically they do get brushed in, some of it with native brush and native species, but also with buckthorn, honeysuckle, which we're constantly battling, not only on our hillsides, but our flat areas as well. We've found that it's not as economical necessarily to hire a hand crew to go in and treat these invasives by hand on bluff prairies or steep slopes. They are very economical in the long run for treating the flatter areas, but nobody wants to carry backpack sprayers and chainsaws up and down bluffs if they don't have to. The goats don't mind it, though. They love it. They're well-suited for it. So we have some goat herds that specialize in conservation grazing. They're specifically trained to graze on these invasive species and to target them. They do still require some monitoring. So if they do start feeding on other species we don't want them to target, then they just get rotated again. So it's just that pasture management, density, stocking rate, timing, all of that still goes into the goat grazing. But they're very economical for treating these really steep hillsides. It's not a one and done. It's not the only tool that we use on those. Typically, we've been grazing 2 to 4 years on our bluff prairies with goats, rotating through multiple pastures, maybe multiple times in a grazing season, and then going in and still hiring a hand crew for a couple of years, or at least a couple of treatments on these same areas. But then they're treating much smaller buckthorn. It's a lot less chemical use. It's a lot easier on the people that are doing it. It's a lot more economical for us to afford it. And then we still come back and try to do prescribed burning on it regularly just for that maintenance phase, then knocking down any of the small seedlings that are getting started, or if there is any seed left in the seed bank, hopefully knocking that out too.
If you are a farmer who is living near a WMA, or maybe it's a Fish and Wildlife Service land too or whatever, has some grassland, and you're thinking, maybe I could, do some grazing. What would be your advice for how they approach the resource professionals and talk to them about that?
Yeah, I say it's definitely worth the phone call or stopping into the office. Just introduce yourself. Talk a little bit about your operation and your goals and how you think you could work together. Don't expect it to be a hit right away. It's kind of one of those things you have to work into your work plan and really digest and take some time with it. So it may not happen immediately, if it happens at all. So I don't know, just maybe keep your expectations low at first, but it's definitely worth the time that it takes to just introduce yourself and have a discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to overhype it, but it is just a prime example of working lands conservation.
Exactly.
I mean, and this is farm country, but it also is some beautiful habitat here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think we do have some more potential. There's just, a few hurdles we have to work through, but they're not insurmountable.
As I mentioned before, the previous episode of LSP's Ear to the Ground podcast featured a conversation with Eric Hines, where he discussed the economics of grazing and how rotating cattle through DNR land has benefited his operation. For links to that podcast and other resources related to building soil health profitably with livestock, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 376 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendell, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.